All right, let's get started. All right, good afternoon. Not much to be announced this week. I think we're now in pretty much cruising mode, at least from the overall logistics perspective. So project is on. Any one of you already had a chance to look at it, think about it? Anybody finished? So I don't think this one is a huge amount of work. Obviously, simulating it might take time. So don't start too lately because it's some of the simulations are going to be quite a number of transistors. And what you will learn is that this tend to be slow. Right? Simulation speed is proportional with the number of transistors. So you have 100 transistors, 1,000 transistors, going to be a lot slower than simulating one inverter. So definitely the one where you have to do the pattern analysis, where you want to basically run complete vectors through, that's going to take some time. The critical path, once you figure out what the critical path vector is, that's one simulation, and that's only one cycle, basically. That shouldn't be too bad. But it's really getting the vectors through that's going to be taking some time. I think we have posters. Do we have posted the vectors already online?
Not yet.
Okay. We should do so. We selected a list, I think, of about 6 vectors that you have to apply to your circuit to demonstrate that it's operational. And in there, there's a variety of things. There's vectors that have no errors. Some of them have one error. Some of them have more errors. So you have to figure out which ones are what. Okay? Question.
Do we have to account for the errors in the checksum bits that we added?
There's some vectors in there that will do exactly that. Yeah, on Friday will be posted. Yes, but there might be cases. I just want to simulate it. What's for the case that there's two errors happening? The system is not going to work. In principle, actually, if you have two vectors, you can if there's two errors, you can detect there's an error, but you cannot correct the error. That's an important one. With the number of parity bits we have, you will see there's something wrong. You will know there's something wrong, but you don't know where it's wrong. While with one error, you can exactly say it's this bit that's wrong. Okay? Good. So, but now the vectors were just chosen in such a way that we kind of exercise all different operational modes. And also the case, for instance, where there's an error in the parity bits itself. Okay? Good. Any other questions on the project so far? I think it's early. Don't wait too long. Some of those things make time. Yes, question.
So I look in the project, and basically the error correction unit will output the corrected data, but it will not output the corrected checksum, the checksum parity bits. So
you don't really care, ultimately, what's coming out. What you could do is obviously you could have a bit, an extra bit, that said something was wrong, or now this is all correct. But from an overall operational perspective, I don't care about the checksum. I only care about the bits coming out of there that say, hey, this is a correct word, the data bits. If you want to write it back for a refresh purpose, let's say, for a soft error, then I would have to basically feed it back to an error encoding unit. But we don't worry about that. Okay, I just care about, I want to see the correct bits coming out. And you might have, as I said, you might have an extra bit that says, hey, everything was right, or an error happened, which is an interesting thing to know. Good. If no more questions, what I'm going to do today, I think we're finished pretty much with the inverter and in terms of CMOS logic. So in the next couple of lectures, starting next this Friday, we'll start looking at some other logic families. So far, we consider everything has to be a PMOS and an NMOS, or a PMOS network and an NMOS network. And while that's a really good logic gate, it might not be the only way of implementing logic. I can do logic in different ways that might be faster, smaller, lower energy, depending upon what. So we're going to look at some of those in the next coming lectures. But before doing so, I would like to add one more topic. There's two topics I'm going to discuss today. Before that, one of them is technology scaling. And technology scaling is kind of a theory. It's what's happening with a number of important parameters like performance, area, power, energy when you go from one technology node to the next one? Can I predict that? If I go from 65 nanometers to 45 nanometers, 45 to 32, what should we expect to happen with the delay of a gate? What will happen with the energy of a gate? And people have studied this very carefully, and actually this whole, what we call scaling theory, has helped us to kind of predict over the years what will happen in the technology 10 years from now or 20 years from now. Actually, there's a committee of people that gets together a bunch of times per year. It's called the ITRS, the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors. It's a group of people that get together and they do crystal ball gazing. Right? They say, okay, let's see what's going to happen over 10 years from now or 15 years from now. How many gates will we be able to put on a on a single chip? What will the power dissipation be? What will the clock frequency be? And so on and so forth. And they do this based on two things, backwards looking and forward looking. Backwards looking is what happened in the past and can I just extrapolate it? Extrapolate from the past. And knowing certain things about technology. The other things they take into account is there might be some new things coming into technology. For instance, I might replace copper by God knows whatever new material that I can come up with. Or there might be new transistors emerging 10 years down the road. Or very often what they also say, if we want to be able to scale down the energy per operation, then we should do some new inventions. Because if we don't do new inventions, we're going to get stuck and things are going to flatten out. So they always kind of push this thing. Like, for instance, right now, and by the way, they're often very wrong. They've been right in many, many cases, but they've often been very wrong. For instance, they have predicted that we would be using extreme ultraviolet type of exposure at the 65 nanometer node. That was the prediction. EUV. It hasn't happened at 65. It hasn't happened at 45. It's not happened at 32. Now they say maybe it's going to happen at 20 nanometers. But maybe not. So you can see that some of those predictions, they say we need it by then, but then people get clever and invent some new stuff and make things happen anyhow. So, but it's an important thing to be able to predict what's going to happen, because if I'm a company like Intel, obviously, I have to advance a long term in advance. My investments have to be done 10, 15 years early. You have to start doing the research now if you want to have a certain things in fabrication 15 years from now. You have to start today. Because first of all, you have to develop the technologies. You have to play around. You have to prototype them. And then you have to bring them into yield. You have to make sure that they produce more than one chip. So that takes a long time and a lot of effort. So that planning process is always going on. And this ITRS roadmap has been driving the industry for many, many, many years. So the prediction now is by the year 2018, we should have 8 nanometer transistors, approximately. So just keep that in your mind that people are already thinking about that far into the future. All right. So scaling of technology. Again, now I discussed this earlier, but I think it's probably worthwhile why we do technology scaling, why it's a good idea. Well, it has to be such that over the years that Moore's Law basically says that with every technology scaling, I'm going to give you the same function for a cheaper cost. That's the bottom line. We go from technology to technology, and what we do is you sell either more function for the same money or you have the same product that's cheaper. Right? And that's been amazing, right? If I look at what has happened over the years, and you just think about yours for yourself, and what you have seen happening in the last 10 years is quite staggering. For $199 or for $299, let's take an example, a play machine, right? Any PlayStation or anything like that, it's always $299. it's the price that people are willing to pay for it. You charge $4.99, you lose a whole bunch of the audience. So $2.99, and you look back at the different Nintendo and Microsoft and all these kind of game boxes, and you see how much more functionality I've gotten in that period of time. It's quite staggering in terms of the graphics, the speed of the processing, the resolution, all those type of things. And you can look at any of those areas. You look at cell phones, you look at computers, you look at anything which is media processing, graphics, all those type of things have gone to that continuous thing. Same price, more functionality. And that has maintained that growth thing. So you can imagine that if that stops, suddenly you have a whole industry that becomes a mature industry. The only thing you can sell from that point on is a different color on the box, like car industries, right? The car industry has gone for a long time into kind of a mature industry, and what you sell is kind of something that looks a little bit more jazzier, or has to be different than the previous one so people think it's better, things like that. So the strength of the semiconductor industry is having to have that capability of basically getting that more function for the same money or making the same products cheaper. But with that comes another set of factors. It's not only price, it's also things like speed. Well, speed has another factor, right? It's the same, more functionality, basically. It has to be smaller or lower power. That's really what they're looking at. So it was actually Dennard at IBM, and Bob Dennard is an amazing person. He's still working at IBM. He must be 80-something right now. But he still shows up at all the meetings, and he's still very active. It's Bob Dennard that really came up with this thing that noticed that scaling, the whole theory of technology scaling. And what his point was that by every technology generation, from one generation to the next one, we scale things by 30% approximately, right? Now, 30%, it's 33%. 33%, you take 33% squared, if everything goes down in size by a factor of 33%, we double the number of transistors per unit area, because this area is 0.33 times 0.33, so you basically get the doubling of the transistor density. It's like this, 0.7 times 0.7 is 0.049. So you're shrinking everything by 30%, doubles me the number of transistors, okay? He also observed that this led to a reduction in gate delay by exactly the same fraction, 30%. Actually, the operating frequency on the average has gone up faster, but that's not only because of the fact that we scale down the gate delay, but that we do some other innovative things on top of it, okay? And the energy per transition has gone down by 65%. Okay, and we'll come back and we'll show you why that is true. Actually, those things are fairly predictable under the models that Bob Dennard basically had been exploring. It used to be that the die at the same time, from one generation to the next one, the die was actually growing with 14%. But that's not happening anymore, because the die basically ultimately got stuck in a certain size. Once you get at a centimeter, making chips of 2 centimeters and things like that becomes very expensive. For a lot of applications, it becomes too big. Okay, so actually, die size has actually flattened out. Technology generation actually span about 2 to 3 years. So every it changes. It used to be every 2 years we get a new technology generation. Right now, it's slowing down a bit. It's about every 3 years we see that technology is going to go to the next step. And as I mentioned, if you see that Intel is now shipping parts in 45 nanometers. They're the first one. They're always the first one. The majority of companies are 65. I talked to a variety of folks out there, and there's a lot of people doing 32 nanometer design today. Not in production, but early prototyping. I was over at Texas Instruments yesterday. That's what they're doing. They're basically designing parts already in 32 nanometers in the early new introduction processes. Okay. This is an interesting picture. Actually, Moore has been right in many things, but there's one area where he was actually wrong, and he admitted it himself. He basically predicted that the wafer size, the size of a wafer, would keep on growing approximately at the same rate as all the other factors. And here's this slide. If you extrapolated where you were in 1975 and you would have followed Moore's law, this would be the size of a wafer today, 57 inches. But it's about as big as a person, really, itself. So never happened. Today, we're basically doing the 12-inch wafers. A bunch of companies, Intel, Samsung, and to a certain extent, TSMC, are pushing for 15-inch wafers. The next step is about 12 inches, about 30 centimeters. They want to go one step higher, like, you know, a little bit bigger pizza. That's really what they're shooting at. And the main reason for that is, hey, it's cheaper for us to produce parts. If we can have more chips on a single wafer, it's a great thing. However, the manufacturers, the guys who have to make the equipment, don't like it very much. It's very expensive to develop new ovens, new everything to fit the 15-inch side. And as a result of that, if you have only four customers, like Intel, Samsung, and TSMC, it's a huge amount of money for a very small set of customers. Yes?
Isn't the probability of corrupt chips going up, in this case, if you just, you know, change
sure.
the diameter?
Yes, absolutely. The yield, you basically are looking back at our yield equations. You're absolutely right. If you bigger wafers, probably going to have more errors on it. But if you look at the, there's two factors. People have gotten better in improving yields on things and defects on the silicon type of substrate. But still, if I can do, say that the yield stays flat, if you, my chip size remains the same, suppose I keep everything, let's add a centimeter, then yes, even if the yield stays flat, I'm going to get more components per run than I had with the smaller wafer. So economically, I'm still getting a gain factor for the guys who basically are producing the chips. And the cost per chip basically could go down as a result of that, because I do more of them in one shot. Okay, so technology scaling. I mentioned 2 to 3 years, 0.3, which means every two generations, we have a 50% reduction in dimension. And this, as you can see here, this has been amazing, right? We've been sticking to this forever. And obviously, this kind of, you might say, well, bye, that's quite amazing. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you say, I want to basically reduce things in five years with a factor of two, then you're going to work towards the fact that you want to reduce it by a factor of two in 5 years. So once you have made the law and then people stick to it, it will happen. That's part of Moore's law as well, right? Once people start believing it. More components per chips. I've shown this before. Propagation delay. As I mentioned, scaling with technology has always led to a similar reduction in propagation delay. So scale technology with 30%, propagation delay goes down with 30% as well. If you go from the early 60s and you look at the delay at that point in time, we're talking pretty hefty delay cycles. Today, gate delays are sitting around picoseconds with the most advanced technologies, which is quite impressive. Power, same thing. Power density, power has also scaled upwards. If you think about it, even if I scale the energy per operation, of every generation, but I put more and more die components on a chip, you will see that the power goes up. So there's certain trends. I'm not going to go into detail on this right now. Let's think a little bit about what makes all those things happen, and why do we believe that? Why does propagation delay scale like, for instance, technology size? Why is that? Yes.
Wondering, what happens to area over time now?
Area of the wafer of the chip.
Of the chip.
Area of the chip has remained practically constant. So it was growing 14% over many, many years. It was every year. Every time you look at the max size people did, it was 40% larger. But then I would say over the last 10 years, it has pretty much flattened out. And this, as I said, there's a couple of reasons for that. It's yield factors is one. But other ones is that for a number of applications, actually larger chips become less and less attractive. Let's say mobiles. If I would have a chip like this, it would be as big as my cell phone, right? Yes.
And when they're talking about scaling, do they mean the digital circuits or do they mean analog or both?
Very good question. If I look at the ITRS roadmap, And I actually, by the way, I think I'll put the latest version of the I2RES roadmap on the website. It's a document that you can find, and it's getting pretty thick. But I think there's one part of the document that's really worth looking into. Is in the past, indeed, there was one roadmap. There was analog, digital, we're all following the same thing. Supply voltage is going to do that and that, that. Size will do that. Memory transistor will be, and so on and so forth. So many analog transistors, that, that, that. Over the past couple of years, we have seen what I call the divergence of the roadmap. That, for instance, even within the digital space, there's different roadmaps. Suppose I want to make microprocessors that are fast for servers, something that goes into your big data centers. Their performance is the biggest thing still. So you go after maximum speed, which means that you're going to keep supply voltage at a certain level, and you're going to basically deal with thresholds. You might actually go for lower thresholds, because lower thresholds give you faster type of performance, gives you more power, but you know, if I'm still concerned mostly about performance, then I can basically choose for the smaller threshold devices. We call that the high-performance roadmap. But in other applications like mobiles, performance is a factor, but not really that important. We don't have 3 gigahertz processors yet into your cell phone. It's too power-hungry. So there's what are called low-power processes, where they keep the VT a little bit higher, the performance is going to be lower, the voltage supply voltage might go a little bit lower as well. So there's different branches. And then you might have DRAM is another completely different story. And analog might be another very different story as well. So there actually might be different scaling strategies for different technologies. But that has a challenge, right? Obviously, in a lot of applications, I would like to integrate as many components as possible on a single die. So if I now have a different technology for memory, different technology for analog, and different technology for digital, it's going to be very hard to put those 3 things together on a single die. So what's happened most often is that you look at how many transistors, what is the most important part of your chip? In microprocessors with periphery around it, it's still the microprocessing. So they say, okay, we're going to pick a digital technology, follow that, and then we're going to see how we can do analog components. They're not going to be as good, but we're basically going to implement our analog components into that digital technology because of the fact we would like to put on the same die. The only other option would basically to be stacked dies on top of each other, and that's what people look at as well. If I have, let's say, a digital chip and I have a memory chip, and I can stack them, kind of put them on top of each other, and then have vias connecting them to each other, I could have a 2 different technologies integrated into a single package, which is happening quite often as well. Again, I suggest if you have a cheap cell phone, I know, maybe the cheap cell phones don't do that. If you have an expensive cell phone, take it apart once you don't use it anymore, because putting it back together is not going to be easy. Look at some of the things there. If actually, there's... Obviously, size is very important. Very often what you will see is things like this. If you can take the plastic away from the chip, you might have 3 chips sitting on top of each other, and they use wire bonding to go between the different layers. But these are basically stacked on top of each other. One of them is going to be a digital chip. The other one might be a flash memory chip. The other one might be, for instance, an RF chip. So in order to basically preserve space, they basically stack them into each other, but they say it's better to use different technologies than trying to put it all into one single die. Okay? All right. Now.
Could we have MEMS and sensors?
Yeah.
Like a processor unit and the MEMS that the sensor.
It's a dream. It's a dream to put sensors on the same die or on top of the die. Most often right now, again, if you take your iPhone, your accelerator is not going to sit on top of that chip. It's going to be somewhere in another part that's an accelerometer. And it's going to be sitting on the same board, but it's not going to be sitting on top of your die. Even though people have been thinking about putting MEMS type of technologies on top of silicon for a bunch of other reasons. Okay. All right. So how did Dennard come to this idea that all those time things, well, he observed it, but then he said, okay, well, actually you can predict this thing. And what he really was looking at is what to say, okay, he created scaling technologies. So how do you scale technologies? What do you have to do if I'm a manufacturing guy? what should I do to go from one generation of technology to the next one? And the scaling technology that was originally adopted to, and actually was the most obvious one to follow, is what they call the full scaling model. The bottom line is when I make things smaller, right? When I make all my dimensions smaller, assume that I do so, right? Scaling of technology means that every dimension gets scaled in the same way, width and length of transistors and thickness of oxides and so on and so forth. That's the ideal case. So what you have to make sure when you full scale, when I make things smaller and would keep my voltages constant, then you can imagine that your electrical fields will grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Now, that's obviously will lead to problems. At some point in time, if I have a very small dimension, I apply a very large electrical field over it, it will have some impact. Impact that basically might impact reliability, or it might impact overall the performance of the circuit as well. So what the full scaling model says now, if you scale the dimension, we're going to scale voltages in the same way, in such a way that the electrical fields remain constant. So full scaling basically means that we're going to do everything, we're going to look at both voltages and dimensions in such a way that electrical fields remain of the same style or the same level over time. Okay? And that's an ideal model. That's really what you'd like to have. In reality, this is not what people did. In the 70s, they said, hey, this is the way you should scale. But the problem was that if I scale from, let's say, I go from one technology to the next, and I keep on scaling supply voltages. Say, at this technology, I use 5 volt, and here I use 4.7 volt or 4.5. You start getting problems of having parts talking to each other and compatibility. If one part port, one chip basically works at 5 volts and the signals coming out there are 5 volt, the other one needs 4.5 volt, I need to put level conversion in between, right? Which is expensive. So what happened for a very long time is that the industry said, okay, what we're going to do is going to scale, but we keep things at 5 volt. 5 volt was a standard for ICs for a very, very, very long time because it was convenient. TTL was 5 volt. Everything else was 5 volt. So it was nice. You could take a bunch of chips, connect them to each other, and you're fine. But the problem is that while you do so and you keep on scaling dimensions, the electrical fields were going up and up and up and up and up. So in order to get that, you had to have what is called slope engineer or gradient engineering. You had some clever guys that said, well, gee, I can play around with these electric fields. If I change, for instance, doping densities over certain areas, like the width of a depletion region can be controlled not only by the electrical field, but also by the doping levels. If I increase the doping levels, my depletion width change is going to remain constant, even if I try to make a depletion region narrower with the same voltage, I basically have just to keep the doping. So you basically keep on adjusting doping levels, so that the electrical field still remain approximately the same. But you cannot keep on doing that. There's other tricks you could play. People use it different, what they call gradient type of diffusions and all these kind of things to be able to deal with it. But ultimately, it created a problem. The other problem is it creates, if I scale technology and I keep my supply voltage constant, what you look at, say, okay, we have CV squared, right? CV squared is the energy per operation. If V is a constant, the energy per operation is going to scale like C. Okay? So by scaling dimension, I will come back to that in a second. If I scale down my sizes, my capacitor might go approximately like 1 over S. Right? 1 over S because the area goes down and is squared, but the oxide thickness or the thickness of the dielectric scales as well, so your capacitor goes down linearly. But I put a squared number of devices on top of that because the things get smaller in a quadratic sense. My same chip will now have a quadratically larger number of components. As a result of that, you can start seeing the power dissipation going up. Right? The power dissipation per component basically goes down, but you have so many more components that the net effect is that the power goes up. So power went up and up and up and up and up and up. We had a problem. So fixed voltage scaling is something that we adhered to for a long time, till the mid-1990s. We went from 5 volt, and then finally said, well, let's do 3.3. Why 3.3? Well, it looks like a nice number. So they went to 3.3, the whole industry. And then they got stuck for a long time at 3.3. till really in the 90s, power dissipation, 1995, 96, power dissipation became so important. And then they actually went back to the full scaling model or something close in between. It's not really full scaling. It's actually what I would call general scaling, where you scale dimensions and you scale voltages, but they might not exactly use the same scaling factor. So let's have a look at that. This is full scaling. Same idea I basically discussed. This is in one technology. This is in the next technology. We scale all dimensions, which is the thickness, the W over L of your transistor, as you can see here. W over L scales. We scale the minimum width. That's the length scaling. But also the depth of diffusions, as well as the size of the drain and the source regions. All of them scales exactly in the same format. Now, this is really what Dinard came up with. Well, okay, let's assume very simplistically, okay, that all the dimensions scale like 1 over S, and let's assume for a full scaling model that we're going to scale at the same time VDD and VT in the same fraction as well. So all voltages, like thresholds and supply voltages, scale as the dimension of your devices. So let's write down some equations. That's going to help us to see what's going to happen with a number of important parameters like the area, the oxide capacitance, the load capacitance, ID, basically the maximum current I'm going to get in, and the R equivalence. So area, the basic equation, is W times L. So we know that W and L scale as 1 over S, so this is going to scale as 1 over S squared. That is easy. The oxide capacitance, the gate capacitance per unit area, scales as 1 over T ox. Actually, it scales as epsilon over T ox, but epsilon is a constant. So you can see that when T ox gets thinner, C ox is going to go up linearly. So C ox will scale as S. This is going to scale as 1 over S squared. Now look at load capacitance. That's an important one. And I'm going to make a little simplification right now. Remember that we said there's a fixed constant between diffusion capacitance and gate capacitance, the gamma factor that we used a number of times? Remember that? So I can assume that the total load capacitance, which is the sum of diffusion cap plus fan out, right? That is going to scale as the oxide capacitance, as the gate capacitance, because I just have to add the factor 1 plus gamma to get the total capacitance, which includes the diffusion cap at that point in time. I'm not considering wiring capacitance, by the way. It's just purely the load that comes from having a fan out of, let's say, 4 happening. So your load capacity is Cox times W over times L, right? So Cox goes up with a factor S, while W and L go down as 1 over S, 1 over S. So we find that the overall capacity, as I mentioned, is going down as 1 over S. So the capacitance per gate, load capacity, is going down as 1 over S. Linearly, right? From one, well, as exponentially, right? From every technology generation to one technology generation, you get 1 over S. I have to protect my little place here. So now that's important. If you look at the propagation delay is what R equivalent times the load capacitance, right? So in order to find R equivalent, I have to basically find R equivalent is the ratio of VDD over the maximum current. Right, that's approximately what my current is going to look like. So maximum current, how does it scale? So ID, think about it. ID scales as Cox is times W over L. Right, W over L cancels out. So we don't have to worry about that factor. Both of them go at the same ratio. So ID is going to go after, it's going to actually increase factor S. And if we reduce the voltages with a factor of 1 over S, we're going to get 1 over S squared, right? So the net effect is that your current is going to scale linearly as well. Okay? You can see that? Current, the overall current I'm going to get over a transistor of a given size is scaling linearly. Now, that allows me to go to R equivalent. What's going to happen with R equivalent? Well, the supply voltage goes down as 1 over S, and your ID set goes down as 1 over S, as we just arrived, your R equivalent remains flat, which is actually approximately true. Remember that I have been talking about R equivalent between, you know, 5 to 10K for a minimum size transistor? And that has been approximately true for a number of technology generations. That the equivalent resistance basically is almost constant. Now, based on that, I can figure out what's going to happen with the overall propagation delay. Propagation delay is R equivalent times basically CL. R equivalent is flat, it's constant, with full scaling, while CL actually goes down. So the net gain in propagation delays comes from the fact that we basically scaled out capacitance. Resistance constant, capacitance scales down. And we get an overall, so TP is R equivalent times CL is going to be equal to 1 times 1 over S, scales as 1 over S. It goes down linearly. And that's exactly what we have been observing for a long time, that we actually scale down, scale technology, and you see that propagation delay goes down as a technology. This is the same thing, so now we can derive some other factors. So as I mentioned, TP is 1 times 1 over S, gives us 1 over S. Cool. Let's think about average power. Average power, the power is going to be equal to the energy, if I have the energy, divided by the propagation delay, right? Because power delay product, power, the energy, which is equal to the energy, is equal to the power times the propagation delay. So if I want to find the power, I take the energy and divide it by TP. So CLVDD squared over TP is the equation approximate that I could use as an example. So let's do the math here. CL goes down linearly, right? So 1 over S, okay? Supply voltage scales as 1 over S squared. So it's 1 over S squared. And we divide this by 1 over S, which is the propagation delay, which I just have derived. So what I'm getting out of this whole thing is that power goes down as 1 over S squared. If I basically look at this per gate, at this power of a single gate, I basically reduce the energy, goes down as S to the third, right? It's 1 over S times 1 over S squared is the energy. CLVDD squared goes down as cubically, third order. But the propagation delay gets smaller, so I'm going to clock it faster. As a net result, the power of a gate scales down over S squared. Clear? Now, if I look at that's per gate, but that's a per gate, that's an interesting number. But from power perspective, I don't care really per gate. What I care about is obviously the total power dissipation of my chip. Or another number that's very interesting is what's called the power density. How much heat do I generate per unit centimeter or something like that, or per unit area? Because that's going to determine how much cooling I have to do. So if I take the average power and I divide it by area, I'm going to get the power density. So I divide 1 over S squared, and I divide it by 1 over S squared, what do I get? It's 1. Right? If I do full scaling, everything goes faster, but everything takes less energy. Net effect is that the amount of heat I'm going to be generating per unit area is going to be flat over the ages. That's cool, but let me go back to one of my previous pictures here somewhere. Power density. This is real chips. There's people who have a lot of time on their hand occasionally.
The power density stays the same.
That's, now, the prediction is it should stay the same, right? If you do full scaling, it should stay flat. One, because 1 over S squared over 1 over S squared. Now, this is reality. So, as I said, some people have plenty of time on their hand. So they go to, let's say, ISSCC papers. They take all the proceedings of ISSCC over the last 10 years or 20 years, and they look at all the chips, microprocessor chips, and they plot power dissipation over the year or power density. And S is scaling factor here. This is, let's say, This is 4 micron. This is 0.4 micron technology. And they plot every dot here is a design. Could be an Intel design, could be whatever. Anything that's been published in terms of power density. And what we observe is it wasn't flat. It wasn't flat at all. Actually, it was more like k to the third. K is equal to s. That's our scaling factor. It's the same thing. So what happened? If I look at 19, let's say here in this region, 1980 to 1990, we saw that power density was going up really rapidly. K to the third. Well, what was happening is that people were not doing full scaling. Remember what I said? We kept the supply voltage constant. Instead of going scaling supply volt from 5 volt, let's say, to 2.7, whatever, keep on going down, they kept it constant. So let's look with our scaling theory. We can do now exactly the same modeling like I just showed you before, but instead of basically assuming that VDD and VT scale up as 1 over S, so let's keep them constant. Right? I just say I'm not going to scale those things down. And I can derive all those things as well. Like area obviously isn't going to change, Cox is not going to change, Cl is not going to change, but your current is going to change. Because now you can see that the oxide capacitance goes up with a factor of 1 over S, as we discussed. But VDD minus VT squared doesn't change at all. It's constant. So instead of having the current of a transistor scale linearly from technology generation to technology generation, actually the current from a transistor is going to go up. And this is going to give you obviously better performance, but obviously it's also going to consume a lot more power. And this is easy to predict. This is, again, this table repeats everything I've been discussing so far. So you have a number of parameters, Cox, Cl, we have your current, you have your propagation delay, your average power delay product is in energy. This is the model that I basically discussed so far. Everything scales with the same factor S, both voltages, both currents, voltage and dimensions. Fixed voltage scaling is the one here. I basically assume that the voltage, VTD and VTH, are basically a constant factor. They don't scale with technologies. So what do we get? Well, you go to the whole math, and what we observe is that our propagation delay doesn't scale as 1 over S, but actually scales as 1 over S squared. That's really neat, because actually our chips go faster, more faster than the technology scaling. Okay. The average power, however, of a gate, instead of going as 1 over S squared, it actually increases with S. And the energy, basically, it doesn't scale as much either. Now, if you look at the power density, which is S over 1 over S squared, if you multiply it out, you get S to the third. And remember what I just showed you? If you look at that curve here again, right here, what I observed is S to the third. And that's exactly what we saw. This was the result of full voltage scaling. We didn't scale the voltage, we scaled the dimension. Power density went up as S to the third. Till 1994, 1995, approximately. And then you can see suddenly the slope is changing, the power density slope. What has happened? Two things happened. Number one is suddenly we didn't like this idea anymore of this power going up all the time. So we started going back to full scaling. Suddenly supply voltage were not fixed anymore, but actually start scaling with the technology. So at 180 nanometers, supply voltage was 1.8 volt. 130 nanometers, supply voltage was 1.3 volt. 90 nanometers, supply voltage supposed to be 0.9 volt, and so on and so forth and so forth. So we actually saw happening that supply voltage were scaling with technology, because they had to. Then you would expect, obviously, this thing to go to flat. Didn't happen either, because there's another factor happened at the same time. Around 1995, we were going to around 100 nanometer technologies, 150 nanometers, 180 nanometers. At that point in time, velocity saturation started to happen. This equation that I showed you before for the current was the quadratic equation, which had a quadratic dependency on voltage on current. At that point in time, suddenly that quadratic equation wasn't holding anymore and the device became velocity saturated. Changes the scaling model as well. Yes?
When did we start stressing the silicon?
Stressing of silicon started for the first generation of 65 nanometers. That was the first generation that people actually started using in their process. IBM tried it first for 90 nanometers, but it really became effective for 65 nanometers. So it is something that happened.
Here we didn't have to worry about it, even though we hit velocity saturation.
No. But what it helps you is stress basically allows you to get, again, your current, higher current for similar voltages. That's really what you get, because you get a better mobility of the devices. Right, so you basically change the equations again. And as a result of that, obviously, a lot of the equations that I've been drawing so far were very nicely valid for the large transistors of the past. But now, with the small dimensions, there's some other parameters that are changing, like mobility, for instance, or velocity. And so our current dependencies with voltages are changing. And we have to bring that into the equations as well. So today, if you go to the ITRS roadmap, and if you're lucky, go to their website, there's actually a bunch of MATLAB models that are available. The way they do these things is exactly like you said, right? I write down my equations. I have a MATLAB, or not MATLAB, Excel. Actually, it's simpler. You don't need MATLAB. Excel is just fine. You put down a bunch of those equations, and then for all the parameters, you look at how are those parameters going to change over the generations. And you put them together. And you say, okay, let's assume now that the technology scales and this scales like that and that. What's going to happen with current? What's going to happen with power? What's going to happen with density? All those kind of things come out of that. But as you can imagine now, these equations are a lot more complex today than they used to be, like Dinard's equation. Dinard's equations were very simple, but very effective because they worked. So another thing that I showed on this table is actually, in reality, we're going back to full scaling, but to be honest, actually, we don't do full scaling anymore either. Because starting with the 90 nanometer node, suddenly you had a problem, right? 90 nanometer, when your voltage was high enough, 3 volt, you scale a bit down. Scaling the thresholds, if the threshold was 0.7 volt, bringing it down to 0.6 didn't matter very much. So we could still scale the threshold. Around 90 nanometers, we started to run into problems with leakage. I scaled my supply voltage and I scaled my threshold. My threshold gets smaller and smaller. Suddenly, leakage power becomes a bigger factor. So what's happened is that thresholds suddenly have stayed flat. We haven't scaled thresholds anymore since 90 nanometers or 130 nanometers. They're sitting around 300, 400 millivolt, approximately. 400 millivolt is a good number. They haven't been reduced because of leakage factors. So now we have another factor that VDD and VT are scaling in different ranges as well. So you can see it becomes... Suppose now that I want to do general scaling, I say I scale my dimensions as one way and my voltage another way, then again I can come up with some overall predictive parameters. Okay? Which is now having S and U as two scaling parameters. I mentioned that velocity saturation happened. What did velocity saturation do? It changed one thing. This. If I look at my ID equation, you can see that the quadratic is gone. It's a linear dependency on voltage. You still have the same dependence on Cox, but the dependency on voltage is pretty much the same. So what we could do is rewrite our equations again for short channel. You have the 1 over S. I plug it all in here, CLVD squared. And what I do is I can create a new table like this one here. So this is exactly the same as I did for long channel devices, but now I do it for less saturated devices. And what you see now, there's some subtle differences. Exactly what you see is that the intrinsic delay right here has become independent of the supply voltage. The voltage drops out, basically, out of the equation. And it's only dimensions that basically is going to determine, independent if I change the voltage or not, to a certain extent. Bottom line is if you have a velocity saturated device and you keep on increasing supply voltage, it doesn't do you any good because you don't get any more current anyhow. right, to the first order. So that's really what this thing says. Supply voltage has become less of a factor in a velocity-saturated device because I don't get that quadratic factor anymore increase. So power density is still the same, though. Power density flat for full scaling. If you have fixed voltage scaling, it goes up as s to the sec as quadratic because the performance doesn't go that fast anymore either. Okay? So that's kind of the whole idea behind technology scaling, the technology scaling theory. What you do is you write the equations down for the important parameters, and you assume certain scaling factors for technology parameters and design parameters like voltages. And then you see what's happening. You predict the future. How many gates will I have? How fast will I clock? Will the power be? And all these kind of things. And it's a very useful exercise to do. As I said, it really helps to think, make the industry think about where things will be 5-10 years from the road. So, as I mentioned, things have gotten a lot more complex, and a couple of factors have caused this model to break. I already mentioned one. Leakage is set by KT over Q, and as a result of that, VT is set to minimize power. VT doesn't scale anymore. Also, temperature doesn't scale because of the KT. KT over Q is a fixed factor. A slope factor, remember, is determined by KT over Q. The only thing I could do, what people have done, to defeat this, obviously, is to say, okay, let's cool down our circuit. IBM, for instance, has put so much money in looking at supercomputers that are cooled by liquid nitrogen, for instance. You cool down the whole thing, and you put it in a room, and you cool. Things are beautiful, right? Because you can see that your subthreshold slope suddenly goes, instead of going like this, it goes like that, which means I can basically reduce threshold voltages, which means that I run things run faster, or the energy per ration goes up. But obviously, cooling a big room is expensive. So it's never been very successful. It's something you might want to do for if you have a lot of money, but actually making things down at running at cooler temperature is not very attractive otherwise. You can go a lot further. Actually, people have shown that CMOS works at liquid helium temperatures, which is about 3 degrees Kelvin. It actually turns out that your transistor at point in time is almost acting like this from the VGF. It's a perfect switch. The resistivity is very good, too. The wires don't have any resistivity anymore. You get very close to superconducting, right? Because resistivity is the result of things kind of scattering around. So really nice thing to operate on. And so it actually makes sense to start thinking about running chips at 25 millivolt at those temperatures. Real problem with that is some uncertainty factor. If you say, okay, I'm going to run at 25 millivolt, I'm going to put my VT at 10 millivolt. Okay. That should work fine. Or 5 millivolt for the VT. The real problem is variability. If there's a whole bunch of uncertainty on your VT, you don't know what's going to happen. Remember what sets the VT is the number of basically dopants and all this kind of thing. So if I'm now suddenly, I shoot at 10 millivolt, but it might be 2 millivolt, or it might be 27 millivolt. You can see that your design is going to be all over the map. So really managing variability at that level becomes very hard. Because if I shrink the mean value, but I don't change the variance, you have a problem. So people have tried this, but it's not a very attractive road overall. Because, again, building those cooling things takes power too. So you say, okay, I can run things at lower power, right? But it takes more power to cool the whole thing down than basically the power savings you make. It's not very good either. So one thing. So factors that basically have that were not taken into account in the whole scaling model I already said. Leakage is set by KT over Q. Power has increased because of leakage, and so on and so forth. So we hit the... And then the other thing that people have done is increasing F faster than device speed by using tricks. What happened is, I mentioned before, right? You look at pure scaling and say, okay, my propagation delay goes down with a factor of 30% from generation to generation. But if I look what Intel did for many years, is they actually make the clock speed 2 times faster from generation to generation. They were cheating. And the way they were cheating is, okay, Well, if you want to basically sell your microprocessor, saying it's going to be 30% faster, kind of people are not very impressed by it. But if you say it's 2 times faster, say, oh, that's cool. So it's kind of pure marketing. So they were forcing their design teams to say, okay, after the next generation microprocessor will be 2 times faster. Whatever you do. So what they did is, okay, well, how do we do that? Well, we get a certain amount from the technology, but we're going to get some other performance improvement by other things. For instance, initially, if you look at the 4040, the length of your critical path, your logic was very long. Whole bunch of gates in sequence. Now, if next generation, what I'm going to do is maybe pipeline a bit, do something like that. Actually, I'm going to reduce the number of logic gates in between two flip-flops. You reduce your critical path from a topological perspective as well. So you can combine topological improvements with improvements in clock speed. Or you can come up with better architectures. As I said, for instance, pipeline stages, concurrent pipeline stages, super pipelining, super threading, super all these kind of things that I came up with over the time, just to keep up that factor too. But then, suddenly, it hit the fan. Suddenly, at the point in time, they were sitting there with microprocessors that were 200 watt, and they couldn't cool them anymore. And that basically has changed the thing. So suddenly say, okay, performance is not the big thing anymore, so things have changed. So the model that we have been describing, this whole nice scaling model, has kind of lost some of its luster in the last couple of years because there's some other constraints that have come in. It's not performance anymore, but it's also power, and it's things like process variations that come into the game as well. But still, it's a very useful thing to think about performance, power, area in a parametric fashion. You say, okay, I'm going to put some scaling factor in it. What would happen if I scale this thing like that? Or if I do this with that? What's going to happen with power? What's going to happen with performance? That's very important. Because if I want to make a business, ultimately I have to be able to sell what's going to be the cost of my part 4 years from now. Right? And I basically make a Wi-Fi modem today, $30. Maybe if I'm going to look at what technologies do, 2 years down the road, 4 years down the road, the thing is going to be $15 or $12. That's an important thing to think about volumes and how much you can produce and all this kind of thing. So you make business models for startups, for instance. You have to calculate some of those things into there. Technology is going to improve, and technology improvement is going to give me that, that, and that, and that. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Okay? Any more questions about scaling? Then let's do this last little thing that I want to discuss today. I want to go back to logic. Right? We're done basically with inverters. We're going to go back to more complex logic. Remember, we've done a lot of stuff with it. We know how to build complex CMOS gates. We've learned how to analyze the performance, how to optimize the performance, logical effort. Remember that stuff? Now, we're going to go back a little bit at the transistor level and say, hey, is the CMOS gate really the best gate? Or might be other ways of doing gate structures? Right? Is there other ways for me to implement a NAND gate, an XOR gate, or all these type of things? And anything I'm going to tell you, you're not going to be able to allow to use in the process in the project, right? Project is pure static CMOS so far. No cheating with dynamic logic and things like that. We're not going to go there. This phase of the project. Later stages, we'll come back to that. Okay? But before I basically talk about gate structure again, there's one more topic I would like to discuss a little bit with you, is layout. Okay? It has been mentioned, was asked before, she said, that layout stuff is a lot of work. Right? Basically, putting out those gates and putting all those polygons down. Wouldn't it be nice to have something like a compiler? Like if I program a processor, I don't write down assembler code anymore, for heaven's sake, right? You write things in C++ or Java or something like that. And then you have a tool out there that generates the whole thing underneath, and I don't have to worry about it. Yeah, and most of the time you think you're doing a good job. Actually, most of the time, if you would look in your assembler code, very often it might be very bad. But you don't care. It works, right? So why do I have to basically now sit there with those gates and fiddle around with polygons and all this kind of stuff? And in reality, that's not what anybody does. In reality, people use compilers, different style of compilers. Compilers to generate their layouts. There's tools by a set of companies, mostly the most well-known is Synopsys, but you have other companies selling the same stuff that allow you to describe your functionality at a higher level. And in this case, mostly it's going to be languages like Verilog, VHDL, and today even C, or some versions of C as well, that allow you to capture the functionality. Say, okay, click the button here, and the thing go chunk, chunk, chunk. Another disk comes in a circuit that meets your speed requirement, or your power requirement, or your area requirements. Now, how do you do that? It's a fairly complex job, right? As you already see, even for the simple blocks we're doing, there's a lot of parameters to play around with. The size of the transistors, and so on and so forth, the placement. Then I have to basically, once I know the logical diagram, I'm not finished yet. So step one is taking Verilog, this high-level language, and turn it into a netlist of gates. NAND gates, NOR gates, XOR gates. And the next thing, what I have to do, which is not the normal thing you have to do with a software compiler, is I have to put these things onto a two-dimensional plane. I have to do a layout, a physical artifact. Now, you might think about an automatic program that would take this netlist and put all the polygons down automatically. And you generate from scratch all the different layers. Could be done, but it's very complex, and it would be very slow. So for a long time, people have followed a different approach, which is even more effective. It's like when I want to write a program, sometimes I might go and say, well, gee, this subroutine here is very important. I'm going to run it over and over again, and the performance of my program is going to be determined solely by this thing because I do it so many times. And what's often happening is people say, it might be worthwhile for those type of things to go in assembler. Or create a library of well-written code, right? Something that's optimized very carefully. So you work with libraries. Somebody else has done the libraries for you, and what you have to do is combine those libraries together in such a way that you get the right performance. And that's what we have done with layout for a long time. I'm going to skip to that. This is our CMOS gate. So what we have used for a long time as an approach is called standard cells. Standard cell says, yeah, gee, it's really stupid to redesign those cells every time around. They always look the same. Anyhow, NAND gates, NOR gates, two input AND gates, three input AND gates, four input AND gates, gates that do A plus B and C, which is called an OR AND function. If you put in invert, it's OR AND invert, or AND OR invert, or AND AND, and all those kind of things are existing. So you create a library of those blocks, you pre-design them, and then you have a tool, once you have netlist, you have a tool that takes all those library elements and kind of puts them together in a structured fashion. So now the key question is how to do this structured fashion thing. And with standard cells, it says the following thing we can really do, right? If we would make it's every cell that we have in a library, independent of what it is, if we would make them all the same height, then I have cell A and cell B and cell C. It's easy to put them together in rows. Right? If I have all the same height, they could have different width depending upon the complexity. An inverter, obviously, is going to be a very narrow thing, and a more complex could be wider, but I can basically stack them in rows. And then I can stack row after row after row, like this, and another row, another row, and then I can have an automatic tool that says, okay, this input has to be connected to this output, and I do some wiring that automatically wires all those things together. So very structured, rows of cells, and then automatic place and route tool that places them in the rows and then does the connections. And that's what standard cells does. It's a technique that became popular, was invented in the early 70s, and started to become very popular in the 1980s with the advent of this automatic synthesis. If I could take high-level descriptions, and then automatically map into netlist. From there on, if I have the netlist, then going to a physical layout became quite simple using the standard cell design. Now, is this the only way of doing the thing? No, because this assumes this is pure random logic. But for instance, if I would build a data path for a microprocessor, data paths tend to be 32-bit, 64-bit, but you have 32 times the same. Like a 32-bit adder is adder cell, adder cell, adder cell, adder cell. And after the adders might be multiplexer, multiplexer, multiplexer. And then register, register, register. It's always the same thing. So in this case, you might actually do what's called bit slices. You put here your adders, and here your shifters, and here your multiplexers, and you make one of those slices, an adder bit, multiplexer bit, and then you repeat it 16 times. This way you can make something which is very nice, very compact, which is important. So data paths used to be generated that way. However, I think if I look now at the latest design that people do, a lot of people say, too much complexity. It's too hard for us. So they actually start using standard cells too. So standard cells is the de facto mode of doing design these days. So let me show you some examples. So here's an example of a standard cell technology. You have rows of cells, a bunch of those, and occasionally you obviously have a block that's something different, like a RAM. A memory is a square block. Right? So you can have macro blocks interspersed with seas of gates. It's really a sea of gate, all of them putting in rows. And then you have wiring in between them. So this, as I said, this has been the same for the last 20 years. But if you look at the chips, and actually I can show you two chips. Here's an example of two standard cell methodologies. This chip was 1980, something like 1987 or something like that, 85. This is a chip of, let's say, the year 2000. Both of them are standard cell technologies. But you wouldn't say it. Well, if you peer very carefully at this thing here, at the right one, you peer very carefully, you will still see the rows. Right? Look very, very, very carefully. You see this horizontal row sitting here, stacked on top of each other. Here, the rows are a lot more evident. So you have a row of cells, another row of cells, another row of cells. But in between there and there's separation. There's white space in between. Can you guess why that was? Why do we have to keep white space in between? No. Nothing to do with shielding or anything like that. Yes?
Technology needs more space between wires.
It has to do with wires. Indeed, right. But it's not per se the more space. You're right. But the cell, everything scales in the same way. The wires get narrower or anything like that. That wasn't really the factor. But it has to do with the wire. This time, there were at most two metal layers. Well, actually, in 1985, there was one metal layer. And so you had to do wiring in polysilicon and metal, which meant that if I have already logic, I have a logic cell, a NAND gate with a bunch of interconnection, that thing is going to use polysilicon and metal. There's no way I could put actually a wire through it. So in order to connect the wires together, what I have to have is special space to put interconnect wires. Like I show in the previous picture here, what we put, we have your cells with your logic, and then you create space in between for the routing channels. I say I have to connect this bit to this bit. What I'm going to do is, let's say, put a little piece of polysilicon here, a little piece of polysilicon here, and put metal one in the other direction. And then for this wire here, I can do polysilicon in this direction, metal one in this direction. So this whole space is filled up with nothing than wiring. So wiring and logic had to be diversified from each other. But then suddenly I have four metal layers, five metal layers, six metal layers, which means that in the cells themselves, I'm only using metal one and metal two maybe. Right? That's sufficient because I only have to make local connections. But all the upper layers I leave free for metal 3, metal 4, metal 5. So what I can do now is to put the routing smack on top of the cells. I can do the connections between the cells at the higher levels of the hierarchy. Which makes sense, right? Because vias take space. To go from diffusion to metal 5 is not an easy step. You have to go, it's like you have to take an elevator. I do a number of steps. So that's why within the cell, you like to use the very thin local wires. If you have to go to further away, you like to use a little bit thicker wires, and you go to the higher levels of the hierarchy. Right? And that's exactly what happens. If you look here, you see that the rows now are stacked smack on top of each other, cell, 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 and the interconnections basically running on top of them using the routers, which makes chips extremely boring. It used to be that it was fun to look at a chip and you see the chip microphotographs, and there was something interesting to see. Today, you look at a chip and you don't see anything anymore. It's filled up and there's all these metal wires. So it's extremely boring. Actually, the most exciting chip I've ever seen, there was a chip that you looked at a chip and you knew what it was doing. It was by just looking at the chip diagram. It was, you ever heard about the blue, what is the blue, not the blue gene, the big chess computer that IBM built that defeated Kasparov 10 years ago. The first time, Deep Blue. Now, Deep Blue was a supercomputer built purely for chess. And what they did, the way they did is, in order to predict a whole bunch of things, they had a special chip which allowed you to do prediction. That chip originated from a project at CMU, actually a university project, and that's that chip that I really said, you look at a chip and you know what it's doing. It had 64 squares. So it had a little processor for every one of the different things. They could say, hey, this is a chess chip right there, because it had 64 squares. So that was a good time, that you could look at a chip and you know approximately what was on there. But these days, it's just pure wires. But anyhow. So again, this has also changed the way we're going to do the layout of our cells. Okay, so if you look at 1980 standard cell technology, here's an example of a two gates. Say this is cell one. Cell one is basically here. This is cell two. What we notice is this is an inverter. If you might see that, there's a NMOS, PMOS. This is what? What gate is this? Should be able to see that approximately. What do you think? Definitely has two inputs. I can see that. There's two polysilicon layer things coming in. So it's two inputs. This is VDD. This is ground. Ground at the bottom. Yeah, this one here. This is an inverter. You should know that. This is an AND gate. Right. Because what you see here is input one, input two. You have one diffusion strip. This is transistor one. Transistor 1 is in series with transistor 2, so we have two NMOS transistors in series. You look here, we have two PMOS transistors in parallel. It's an AND gate. But what you see in the structure, what we do is we bring the inputs in. VDD and ground are run vertically, okay, horizontally. VDD and ground, two strips that are run, and you can see by stacking the cells next to each other, you automatically extend the supply rails. Oops. Uh-oh. I should start bringing my adapter back. It's actually 5 minutes shorter than last time. Okay, I'm going to basically walk you through. You have the picture here. You have the handout. I cannot point to it. I was hoping. Oh, yeah. I can. Yes, you can use the overhead camera. That's good. Can I get the overhead camera? I should get the color printouts too. Can we zoom in a little bit more? Zoom, zoom, zoom. There we go. Okay, and I can write on it. Good. Thank you so much. That was a good suggestion. So you can see here what we do is VDD and ground are run horizontally as strips, and by basically abutting cells next to each other, you automatically extend the power supply network. They automatically extend that, so I put more and more cells together. I don't have to do VDD and ground routing. It's automatically there. The inputs are brought in vertically to polysilicon. So if I want to connect to the cell, there's an input one, input here, input two. This is the input of my inverter. Same thing. So you have your the transistors are horizontal. These are my transistors. And then you have your output. You bring the output also back to the edge of the cell. So from the overall perspective, what I have is a cell with VDD and ground connection. And then I have a number of input-output connections at the boundary of the cell. The same thing with the inverter. This is the input. This is the output. Then I have my routing channel here. What the routing channel is going to do is connect those things together. Say, oh, the output of this cell connects to the input of the next one. So here's your routing channel. Okay? Now, in our new strategy, there's no reason whatsoever anymore to bring the inputs and the outputs to the boundary of the cell. Because remember, I'm going to route at the next higher layers up. So I'm just going to keep input and outputs internally. So there's no routing channels anymore either. So I'm going to have my VDD strip, my ground strip, and my two cells. And you can see my inputs are just strips of polysilicon that are floating in the air. Now, in order to connect to them, I'm going to basically have to have a contact and bring them to the next higher level. Like, for instance, the output of this thing here, the output of this cell is metal, and I bring it to the next cell by routing metal and connecting to the polysilicon. So no more routing channels. That saves a lot of space. There's another thing I can do now, which is quite interesting. You look at the VDD here, I show you a double width. What should I do with the next row of cells? I really want to be efficient. What I could do is say I bring another layer of cells on top of here. But rather than having the ground at the bottom and the VDD on the top, now we're going to do the VDD at the bottom and the ground at the top. I'm going to mirror them so that I can share the VDD and the ground between the two cells. There's a shared strip. But there's something else I can share, which is even more important. What's that? If I do that mirroring of the cell, if I now have here my new cell here, here am I going to be my PMOS transistor at the bottom, the NMOS at the top. What else can I share? The rails are already shared. Did I show that? The wells. Right? Because now the well, this is going to be all PMOS devices. And remember, well separation takes space. Now you have neighboring cells actually going to, on top of each other, are using the same well as well, which again allows me to go denser. Okay? So I have a couple of examples of different standard cell strategies in the next set of slides, and I just suggest that you look to them. It's different strategies that people use. And for instance, if you look at slide 29, slide 29 shows two different versions of how cells could look like depending upon the technology options you have. Like here is a traditional process. This is a more advanced process. In this process, I don't have silicided diffusions. Remember silicided diffusions? If I have a silicide available in my process, silicide is silicon with some other dopants into it, like tantalum or something like that, make it more metallic. Diffusion itself has a fairly high resistivity, right? N plus, even N plus is not a very good conductor. So if I have here a transistor, this is my PMOS. See, my NMOS is obviously narrower, doesn't have the same width as the PMOS. The PMOS is wider. We know that that has to be. So that's a fairly long, if you look at the overall transistor size, this is the output, this is the connecting to VDD, let's say. And this goes to the output here. You can see that in order to reduce the resistivity of the source to VDD, instead of having one contact, I provide 1, 2, 3, 4 contacts. Just resistivity reduction. Because otherwise, I have my PMOS, and I will have a resistivity here in series with my PMOS source and with the CMOS drain as well, which is going to slow me down. So putting a lot of contacts in there basically reduces the amount of resistivity because I'm making now my connectivity in metal. I have a metal layer sitting on top. However, if I have a silicide is a layer of silicide put on top of the diffusion, like the sandwich thing that I showed you before, like silicided gates, it reduces the resistivity of my source and drain regions. In that case, I don't have to worry that much about contacts. I can live with one single contact here, another contact here to connect to the output. So that's an example of what technology can do. This is another example, is a two-input NAND gate and so on and so forth. So I'm going to hold it for this right now. Now, one thing I'm going to would like to show you before we go to the next step is this, how in the world, if I, let's say, have a fairly complex gate, how in the world do I decide on the topology of where to put transistors, how to order them in such a way that I get the best possible layout for me? Because you can have different options, right? There's not a single way of doing let's say I have a 4-input NAND gate or a 4-input OR gate or XOR gate or whatever. There are multiple ways of ordering the inputs and the outputs and so on and so forth, and it might lead to very small designs and big designs. Turns out there's actually a fairly simple trick or a simple strategy to figure out how you should do it. and I'll show you that. It's called the idea of the consistent Euler paths. Just to put something in your head, paths, Euler, and consistent are the three words that you have to remember. Okay? All right, we'll talk about that on Friday. See you then. And I'll bring my transformer with me at the point in time.
I was looking at the cadence PMOS that we use.
Right.